Now, once in a while, I get a letter from some impatient person asking, why don't we get it over with? Why don't we issue an ultimatum? Make all-out war. Drop the atomic bomb. For most Americans, the answer is quite simple. We're not made that way. We are a moral people. Peace is our goal, with justice and freedom. We cannot, of our own free will, violate the very principles that we are striving to defend. The whole purpose of what we are doing is to prevent World War III. Starting a war is no way to make peace. But if anyone still thinks that just this once bad means can bring good ends, then let me remind you of this. We are living in the eighth year of the atomic age. We are not the only nation that is learning to unleash the power of the atom. A third world war might dig the grave not only of our communist opponents, but also of our own society, our world as well as theirs. Starting atomic war is totally unthinkable for rational men.
On January 15, 1953, President Harry Truman delivered his farewell address to the nation. Our guest, historian and Truman scholar Richard Kuykendall, has described that address as a bold statement that challenged widely held views in Truman's time and anticipated what has become the dominant view of him in our time. Professor Kuykendall was in Independence, Missouri in January. He spoke at the Truman Presidential Museum and Library on the Truman Farewell Address, inaugurating that institution's 50th anniversary commemoration of that event. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you.
In what ways did Truman's farewell address challenge widely held views in his time?
Well, the polls suggested that most Americans regarded him as a failure, and the address clearly challenged that and began to turn public sentiment around.
And how did it anticipate what would become the dominant view then?
Well, beginning in the 1970s, Truman emerged as a national hero. I wouldn't say that he's free of critics now. He has some critics in the historical profession as well as elsewhere, but a lot of evidence suggests that he's widely admired and that there's a great deal of enthusiasm for him in the country. Politicians have been identifying with him for quite a while. There's an abundance of evidence along those lines.
Has it been a gradual process, or did it turn over at one particular point?
I think the collapse of the Nixon presidency began the process, and it moved forward very rapidly there in the middle of the 1970s. Among other people, Gerald Ford gave it a big boost after he became president. And it moved forward rapidly again in the early 90s with the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Empire, and the collapse of the Soviet Union.
And did it change among historians and the general public, or one or the other, or did one precede the other? How did that work out?
Well, historians in the early 60s, mid-60s, became fairly positive in their interpretations of Truman as historical research got underway dealing with Truman. Though historians did split then in the late 60s, early 70s, and many historians, I think, were appalled that Truman had become a national hero. But by now, though some critics in the profession are still at work, critics of Truman, the dominant sentiment in the historical profession, as well as with the public, seems to be quite positive.
Okay, well, let's get back to the address itself. What were the major points that Truman made in his address?
The address emphasized foreign affairs and Truman's accomplishments in that area. The address suggested that Truman and his aides had learned the lessons of history and had avoided a repetition of past mistakes. By that, they meant mainly mistakes made in the 1920s and 1930s that they regarded as responsible for World War II, and that Truman had behaved in a very different way than the leaders in the United States and also in Western Europe, had back in the 20s and 30s. Beyond that, the address predicted that the Cold War would end in a way favorable to the United States and the West. It would end with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And it would end that way if the United States continued to pursue the policies that had been established under Truman's leadership. And it would end that way in part because there was a fatal flaw in the Soviet system that would contribute to the collapse of that system.
Okay, so we're in the middle of Cold War here, a challenge, a struggle, if you will, with the Soviet Union. You made reference to mistakes that were made in the 20s and the 30s. Maybe you could just be a little more specific. What mistakes in particular, and then how would that apply to our engagement with the Soviet Union?
Well, as Truman saw it, the first mistake had been the American rejection of participation in the League of Nations. And then beyond that, there was the mistake of military weakness during the 1920s and 30s, which was very important from Truman's point of view. And there was the failure to respond quickly and forcefully to Japanese expansion in the 1930s, and then the expansion of Mussolini's Italy and Hitler's Germany in the mid and late 1930s.
Now, after World War I, a similar message was sent out. Wilson certainly sent out this message about the League of Nations, but the nation just wasn't ready to hear about that. Was the response different after World War II?
Yes, the country was strongly supportive of the idea of joining an international organization and providing leadership in the development of an organization. And Truman, as a senator, had been one of the champions of that in 43 and 44. Truman was also a champion of a strong military. There was not as much support for the military right after the war as there was for the building of an international organization.
Now, there were also issues, however, of economic matters and race relations. Did he bring those up in his address as well?
He did bring them up, but a feature of the address is the small amount of space devoted to those domestic issues. There are just a few sentences in contrast with the fairly substantial treatment of international matters. He did say that the United States had learned how to make their economic system work effectively. And he did express pride in his accomplishments in that area. And he expressed the idea of change in race relations. He saw an awakening of the American conscience in that area. And those were both the economic matters and the race relations matters, important elements in the Truman presidency, but the address didn't give them nearly as much attention as it gave to international affairs.
What was the general history of the economic situation during the Truman administration? What did he have to wrestle with? Was it all prosperity so he could just coast, or were there difficulties with which he had to deal?
Well, at the outset, there was a big fear that the United States would slip back into a depression. The idea was that the war, and especially the government spending that came with the war, had been the factor that finally had moved us out of the depression. So what was going to happen when the war was no longer pressing us to spend vast sums? So there was a fear of a post-war depression. And the administration had to grapple with that possibility. And the United States, for a variety of reasons, avoided a post-war depression. And then, with the coming of the Korean War, the economy moved forward very rapidly in Truman's years.
And there were similar issues, difficulties, if you will, in race relations, including a position that he took that led to an interesting development in the election of 48 and recent political squabbles that went on. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Truman came to office with some sympathy for the aspirations of black Americans for change in race relations. And the Cold War with the Soviet Union gave that sentiment a boost in his mind and in the minds of his lieutenants and in the minds of many of his countrymen. And in response to that, he made a number of moves as president. He came out, for example, in February of 1948 for the passage of broad civil rights legislation. That led to a split in the Democratic Party, and that split has received a lot of publicity lately with the retirement of Strom Thurmond, because Strom Thurmond became the leader of anti-Truman Democrats in 1948. They set up an independent party, and that party chose Strom Thurmond as the presidential candidate. Another area in race relations in which Truman was highly significant was the promotion of the desegregation of the armed forces. And, of course, we're seeing a lot about that these days because of one of the beneficiaries of that was Colin Powell.
Okay. Well, let me take you back to a comment you made earlier. You said quite early on that, you know, when Truman was leaving office, he certainly had low marks in terms of public opinion. Yet things we've been talking about, race relations and foreign affairs, from the perspective of 2003 would perhaps tempt us to believe he was a great success. So let me take you back on what factors led to Truman's failure to achieve higher marks when he was leaving office.
The most important factor was the Korean War. That war was dragging on, and it was, by 1951, highly controversial. There were various proposals as to how to end it. The most prominent proposal came from General Douglas MacArthur. MacArthur challenged Truman, contrary to the ethic of the professional military person, and Truman fired him for that. But Truman couldn't find a way to bring the Korean War to an end. And Dwight Eisenhower made a good deal out of that in the 52 election, and he promised to go to Korea if he were elected. The promise implied that he would be able to do something that Truman hadn't been able to do, and the promise contributed to Eisenhower's impressive victory. Other factors were what people regarded as a high cost of living. There were charges of corruption in the federal government, and some people blamed Truman for that, pointed to his associations earlier with the Pendergast machine in Kansas City. And there were charges of communists in the federal government, and Truman was portrayed by his critics as weak on that issue.
So did Truman try to counter that with his farewell address?
He didn't talk at all about the communist in government issue. He didn't talk at all about the corruption in government issue. His response to the high cost of living was to point to how well the economy was going. He didn't explicitly confront the high cost of living question. He just pointed out that the American economy had never worked so well, and by that he meant that it was providing a high level of employment, and he suggested that income was distributed more fairly than ever before.
So why was the address important then?
Well, it was important to Truman and to the people that participated in the writing of the address because they wanted to make a challenge to this criticism, this widespread criticism of Truman. They wanted to suggest an alternative. And the address is important in the long run because much of what was said in the address worked out. Truman, for example, had suggested that if we pursued these policies that he would established, we would avoid World War III. Well, we have avoided World War III. And he suggested that if we pursued these policies and took advantage of what he called the fatal flaw of the communist system, eventually the Cold War would end in a way that was desirable from the American point of view. Mm. And that, in fact, has happened.
Okay. And maybe that's where we'll leave it. That's a good point. So thank you for joining us, Richard.
Thank you very much, Brian. Okay.
You've been listening to Richard Kuykendall, Scott and Dorothy Bullitt Professor of History Emeritus at the University of Washington. For more information on the Truman Presidential Museum and Library's year-long commemoration of the Truman Farewell Address, visit the website at www.trumanlibrary.org.
We've made progress in spreading the blessings of American life to all our people. There's been a tremendous awakening of American conscience on the great issues of civil rights, equal economic opportunities, equal rights of citizenship, and equal educational opportunities for all our people, whatever their race or religion or status of birth.